Alrighty, this is day three at the 56th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother Ron Hoban on Dirt to Diamonds. The subtitle for today is One Dazzling Dozen. This is the second talk in a series, and the introductory reading was Exodus 28, verse 1 to 12.
Excellent. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Gordon. Nice to be back again this morning. Another gorgeous day, isn't it? Beautiful out there, and such a blessing that it's not that funny that it's a nice day. So we into our second talk on the theme of dust to diamonds, and just a quick recap. We looked at this one as being our key verse in the story, this idea of transformation, this idea that God can take essentially the most basic material, dust, and in the end he's going to produce this incredible, glorious picture which we see in Revelation of these gemstones of the highest quality. But the key is that it's God's work, it's not ours. And like in the process of us, you know, living our lives, we're often trying to change our lives by our own power and by our own might. The secret to this story is the fact that if we allow the hand of God in our life, the magic happens by him, and he wants it to happen by him. And that's why Paul, as we said, saw himself less and less and less, because he realized who he was, and he gets to that stage where he just sees himself as the greatest of sinners, the least of all saints. But in that process, it's interesting that he becomes more confident in God's ability to save. But also, I think if you follow through the life of Paul and read through his writings, he actually becomes more and more compassionate and caring. Early on in Paul's ministry, you could see that sometimes he was perhaps a little bit hard on people. The conflict that happened with John Mark is very different to the end of Paul's life when in 2 Timothy he says, oh, bring John Mark because he's profitable for the ministry. So you can see how it changes. He's actually become a man of compassion and care. And that's the secret of seeing ourselves as dust. When you see yourself as dust, Paul writes, esteeming others better than yourselves. So when you get down and you see yourself as dust, it helps you to appreciate the glory in other people. It helps you to see the quality in the gems in other people. And so our first study was looking at this idea that we are dirt. This one is really to see and appreciate the glory in other people. And this is really the story that we're looking at in terms of the development of the spiritual quality within the gemstones. So remember we said, here was the land of Eden. This is where it all began. And out of that land, there were different resources that came out of the ground. God used dirt to make man, but then he talks about these three different things that are there in the land. And I'm convinced the only reason God shows us this is to show us that he can use all of those materials, but this is his work of what he's going to make. So out of the ground comes precious stones, gold. Gold is the most, or valued as the most precious stone. Onyx, of course, being a crystal, a mineral. And then bdellium, which is a living organism, which comes from trees. It's gum. But all of those things were used in crafting. So this morning, we're going to focus a little bit on one of these things. And the next two sessions, we're going to focus on another couple of the other two items. So today, we're going to focus really on this idea of the onyx stone. It's a little bit of a debate because onyx comes in all, you get black onyx, red onyx, green onyx, white onyx. Onyx has a massive variety within its own right. I think it's part of the chalcedony family of stones. In fact, what's amazing is that a lot of these stones have huge variety of colour. You know, like when you get to Revelation, it says the whole thing was of jasper. Like that's the beginning foundation stone for New Jerusalem. So I went thinking it was clear like jasper. So you go and try to find jasper, and guess what? Jasper comes in every different colour you can imagine. You get tiger jasper and red jasper and spotted jasper and jasper from all around the world. Everything, it's got such variety. So it's like, well, that's the point, isn't it? So this is probably what they suggest is the sardonyx stone. This is what you might call the white sardonyx stone. And the interesting thing that in the Greek of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, the word that's used here for the onyx is a word which is the same word which is like used for a fingernail. So it's like that white flesh, and you can actually see the flesh underneath the fingernail, and it's a cognate word. Because the white onyx actually has like veins. So it's beautiful, but it actually like has red veins of flesh within the onyx stone. So I think that's kind of interesting in the story. So this is what was there in the land of Havilah, which surrounded the area of Eden. Now that stone appears a number of times, and of course we're looking at this picture of the 12 stones, which we find on the breastplate in Exodus chapter 28. It's also again in Ezekiel chapter 28, when it talks about the king of Tyre, and it mentions all those stones again, and they are actually the same, they match up. And then, of course, it mentions again in Revelation. Now, what's interesting with the onyx stone is it's actually the thing the whole breastplate sits on. So what it says of the onyx stone, it says, you shall take two onyx stones. We just read it in Exodus chapter 28, verse 9. You shall take two onyx stone and hang the breastplate off it. And what did they do with the two onyx stones that were hung off the breastplate? They engraved them. So on one side were six tribes, and on the other side were six tribes, and they were engraved in these stones upon which the breastplate hung. Now, of course, this is very much the same as when we look at Revelation. So you go to Revelation, and it says there was a massive high wall, and there were 12 gates with 12 angels on the gates, and the names of the 12 tribes of Israel were written on the gates. So you had the tribes of Israel written on the gates, and then it says the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and the names of the 12 apostles were written on the foundations. So follow that? 12 tribes on the gates, 12 apostles on the foundations. So this is the same principle of what we find in the story of Exodus. Now, we didn't read Exodus chapter 28, verse 12, but if you're still in Exodus, have a look at verse 12, because I think this tells the entire story. Now, I don't know what translation people have got, but mine is the ESV, and I think the ESV and the NET are the same. And it says in verse 29. So Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment on his heart when he goes into the holy place. That's a beautiful phrase. He shall bear the name of the 12 tribes on his heart. And we just sung, I heard the voice of Jesus say, come unto me and rest. Come and lay down your head upon my breast, upon my heart. And I came to Jesus and I found rest. And that's the principle of the breastplate. He was to bear the 12 tribes on his heart when he went into the holy place. His responsibility was to bring the children of Israel on his heart. And we have a high priest, don't we? Touched with the feelings of our infirmities, who bears us in all our diversity and all our different characteristics on his heart when he goes to the Father and makes intercession for us. So this is a beautiful picture. So when you look at these 12 different stones, and these are the foundation stones of New Jerusalem, it's quite hard to determine exactly what stones they are. In Revelation, we've got a pretty good idea because we know what stones were around in the Roman world at that day. The exact stones that were used on the breastplate and in Ezekiel chapter 28 are up for a lot of debate. So when I first started doing this study, I had this really fancy, cool idea that I was going to be able to look at these 12 stones and I was going to be able to identify exactly what the stones were and to be able to match them up with different personalities and characters. And so then I read about 500 different experts on this that all had about 500 different opinions.
Sounds like Chris's
offense. Yeah. And realised that that just was not going to happen. So, and these were experts, by the way, in Greek and in Hebrew. Yeah. So anyway, it's pretty hard to do. And I think there's an interesting point with this, is because I don't really think we should be doing that anyway, now that I've got that. That's the easy answer, isn't it? Because I think, you know, like the idea is definitely diverse personalities and diverse characters. They represent, when you think about, you've got 12 stones representing 12 tribes of Israel, you had 12 sons of Jacob, you had 12 apostles. So this number 12 is used over and over again in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, as a representation of different personalities, of different characters. Well, as I say, both in relationship to Israel and in relationship to us. Now, this is where I will go into some of these personality tests. If anyone's been in the corporate world for the last sort of 30, 40, 50 years, you've ended up having to do some sort of personality test. There's hundreds of them out there. Most of them are all based on this really early writing of Hippocrates, which is like 400 years before Jesus, and like he was a philosopher, and he had this idea that, you know, when people were like angry people or people were, you know, melancholic, like Eeyore off Winnie the Pooh, oh dear, oh my, that it was something to do with their bodily fluids. So he put them all into characteristics of phlegmatic, choleric, sanguine, melancholic, and like if you think they sound like bodily fluids, it's because they are. The idea behind that is that choleric was there was some disorder in the blood, sanguine was yellow bile, phlegmatic, phlegm, lovely, melancholic, well that's black bile, so ugh. So, and it was all about, you know, the fact that some people had real high energy, some people were outgoing, some people were introvert, some people were task-orientated, some people were people-orientated, and so it was a way in which to put people in different boxes. Most of that went out the door, incidentally, when they, you know, discovered that most people's sicknesses and illnesses and mental things came from pathogens running around through their blood systems were causing all of this as opposed to their bodily fluids. So a lot of that went out the door. But it was really picked up again in more recent times. And there's been some really good ones. And there's some good things about this, and there's some bad things about this. The good things are is when you go through and do personality tests, it is interesting to see that we do have, you know, some sort of dominant personality. But the danger of it is putting people in boxes. And that's dangerous, to put the people in boxes. But it is worth thinking about different personalities. So this is one that I did, which is very popular. I don't know if anyone's done this one, the DISC analysis. It's become very popular. One of the most popular ones in more recent times. So the idea is you have the DISC, you have four different major personalities. You have people that are dominant, inspiring, cautious, and supportive. The words kind of go with it. So with D, you've got people direct, demanding, decisive, determined, doers. They're normally the strategic planners, those with lots of foresight that can, the visionaries, the inspiring people. Those are people that like to talk with their hands, and they're normally people outgoing. You probably know which category I fit into. And they're normally quite opposite to the C people, because the cautious, concise, contemplative are normally your engineers and architects that like fine detail. And if you ask my wife, I'm not so good on the fine detail. Supportive people are really, you know, people in touch with, you know, feelings and carers and people, you know, stable, steady, sweet, good S words. This one was very popular. This is probably the most popular one in the world today. This is what's called the Myers-Briggs. Yeah, anyone done that one? Yeah, that's probably the most popular one. Myers-Briggs had this thing of actually taking the four different major personalities and then dividing it into subcategories so that you had 16 different types of people within those four categories. This one's now seen to be quite dangerous, because there's a lot of stuff going on in America at the moment where major employers are biasing their employment processes by saying, looking for people that are ISFJ, and then discounting everybody else that's applied for the application. And so this is seen as discrimination. So there's court cases going on now over this. So it is quite interesting. This is another one, Don Lowry, the colour one. But all of these most modern ones that are out there, so the colour one pretty much based on Hippocrates thing, most of these modern ones all came from this guy. So this guy was really the genius behind most of the ideas that come with the modern personality psychoanalysis tests that were out there. So this guy, Carl Jung, he's a genius, really. He was very, very good friends with another character, Sigmund Freud. They were like best friends. Sigmund Freud was just basically this guy that, in terms of understanding the neural pathways and the way the brain works and that, he was just revolutionary. So what's interesting about this guy is he majored in all sorts of things, but one of them was religious studies. So he spent a lot of time reading the Bible, and he actually based a lot of his stuff on terms of the personality on understanding the concept of different personalities within the Bible. And what he did was he said there's four major personalities, but there's like 12 sub-personalities underneath those. Well, that's what he designed. So within their different personalities, he had people that were carers, rulers, artists, innocent sages, explorers, outlaws, but they came from people that provided structure, the visionaries, the spiritual journalists, those that like to connect to others, and those that like to leave a mark on society. And what's interesting is, in looking at these, it's quite fascinating that you can actually put the story of the cherubim right beside these, because when you think about the ox, it is the face of the cherubim. It is very much that careful, concise, powerful beast which needs direction. It needs to be harnessed, but give it a direction and it is very, very powerful in where it's going. The eagle, of course, is strategic. It's always planning ahead. It can see a long way, tends to be a little bit aloof, tends to be a little bit judgmental sometimes. That's why the eagle looks like a judge in a courtroom. The man, of course, touch with the feelings, the humanistic side of things, those that like belonging and intimacy. And, of course, the lion, the hero, the one that likes to be at the front, the one that likes community, the pride of lions. So when you look at those, you can kind of see that. I found this one really interesting because what they did is a lot of brands have done this. So they've put brands. So you can run around and have a look at some of those brands and where they fit in amongst this. And I just found some of these really fascinating. I mean, Lover down here, and it's Cadbury, chocolate, and Ferrari. I mean, a red Ferrari and chocolate. I mean, who is not going to win a girl's heart, eh? I mean, that's like just right out there. So, anyway. So when we look at these stones that are found in New Jerusalem, we know they represent the different tribes. Which stone represented which tribe, a lot of people have done lots of work on, and as I said, no one's really worked it out. The Exodus and Ezekiel ones, they've tended to just go by the order of the tribes and the order of the gems that are listed and match them up. But that kind of gets messed up because when you look at Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33, Moses writing to the tribes, the orders change a little bit. So at the end of the day, it's really just guesswork. But this principle that Carl Jung had in his psychoanalysis is actually interesting, isn't it? Because we know that the 12 tribes were there in order and they marched under four banners. They marched three tribes under each banner. So there is order and structure. And in fact, people have done, like they did the Myers-Briggs with the 12 sons of Jacob. And you know that the 12 sons of Jacob, when you read Genesis chapter 49, it's a fantastic chapter, but it's definitely all about personalities. You can see their personalities in there, can't you? I mean, Reuben, super ambitious, go-getter. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my excellency and power. You shall not excel, because he overstepped the mark. A little bit overambitious. Simeon and Levi, anger management issues, eh? A little bit intense, those two boys. Instruments of cruelty, swords of cruelty, he said. So you can go through and you can see these characters of the sons of Jacob, and you can see them in their different personalities. By the way, one of the ones I did do, which is interesting if anybody wants to do it, I found it fascinating, is the disc analysis, D-I-C-S. You can do this one as a biblical disc analysis. So there is available online. It's called the Biblical Disc Analysis. You can apply for it. They'll send you a questionnaire. You can fill out a questionnaire, and it'll align you with certain Bible characters, which is kind of cool. Or not cool. Tough if you all end up being Judas, don't it? So. Anyway, that is an interesting little study. One of the things that comes out of the Genesis 49 record, which I really love, is as you go through the different sons, the 12 sons, they are likened to animals, a lot of them. Judah, lion, cool. Issachar, donkey, very good. Dan, serpent. Naphtali, a hind let loose, Naphtali is. Benjamin, Raven is a wolf. So as you go through these 12 sons, you get through a lot of them are likened to animals. Now, I think Zach knows this word because I think he did an exhortation on this. What is this called? Anthrop. Anthropomorphic. Didn't you do something on anthropomorphic? Oh, you had a different word. Ah, okay. Yeah. So, anthropomorphism is the likening of people to different animals. And I think there's one example that I want to look at in this, which is kind of cool when we're thinking about the gems, and it's what we did in the readings just yesterday. So it's Genesis, Job chapter 39, or Job chapter 38 and 39. Because what happens in these chapters, you know, the story of Job, I love this. You've got this incredible thing that goes on where through this story, obviously, Job is afflicted by God, and then he's got his three miserable comforters that come around him to try to comfort him, and then they get into this debate over why this has happened to Job. And Job's answer really is, I don't know why it's happened. I believe in God's power, but I think God must be unjust. And he actually does. That's what he's actually saying. Our most famous thing in Handel's Messiah, I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that at my last day I shall stand, and I will be vindicated. So when he's talking about his Redeemer, he says, I'll stand before God, and my Redeemer will vindicate me as being right. So that's where Job's problem was. His three friends turn around and says, well, bad things happen to bad people. I don't know what you've done, Job, but going by what's happened to you, you must have a lot of skeletons in the closet. They thought he must have been real bad. He must have been hiding something pretty bad to have all of that going on. And everyone's waiting for God to answer. And when God finally answers out of this storm in chapter 38, you're like, well, somebody's got to make sense of this. This is all got to make sense. And when God answers, he gives them a nature lesson. It doesn't really answer the problem of why these things happen. It's just like, well, where were you, Job, when I laid the boundaries on the earth and stopped the sea from rolling in? Where were you when I created the mountains? Where were you when I set in order the stars? How can you charge me with injustice, Job, when you don't understand how I work? You don't understand my power. You can't comprehend what I do. But all of those things, awesome power, but they're all constructive, isn't it? In the end, God is saying, I am constructive, not destructive, Job. I do not do anything without purpose, Job. Just because you don't understand the purpose and how I'm working, you can't charge me with injustice. And then he gives this lesson on animals. So at the end of chapter 38, he starts talking about animals. And when you go through, there's actually 12 animals mentioned in chapter 38 and 39. And he pairs them off together. Six pairs of animals. Now, I think this is remarkable to our story of the gemstones. And what he does is he looks at these animals. Here they go. So when you think about the diversity of animals, we've already met this guy and this one at the bottom. The thing with animals, this one at the bottom, platypus. This is one of the animals which really messes with the evolutionist, because this one really hasn't decided what it's going to be. It's got a duck bill, seal feet, platypus like a half otter, half beaver, half duck, half seal. That's a lot of halves. Anyway. So it's a weird animal. And you know, this guy's there. He's watching this animal down here, and you know what he's thinking, eh? It's like, yeah, that creature's so weird. So this story of Job, which I love this picture, by the way. I think this picture just like it's one of the most awesome pictures of demonstrating the power of the story of Job, is trying to make sense of things that happen in our lives. And in this, God introduces, and it starts in chapter 38, and he starts talking about two sets of animals, and he's talking about their dietary behavior, and he pairs the lion with the raven. So he says, will you hunt prey for the lion, or fill the appetite of the young lions when they couch in their dens and abide in the covert and lie in wait. So God says, I provide for the lions. By the way, this is an answer to Eliphaz's words earlier, who says, oh, lions get what they get. I've seen them grow old and their teeth fall out. And God's saying, no, I provide them. By the way, for those who are international and haven't seen a good rugby tackle, you're about to see the best rugby tackle ever. It's pretty awesome. That was a setup from the start. So those lions just hounded that deer and got him so that the one that was lying in wait can pounce. Now God's saying, I provide for that. And then the other animal is the raven. Now we don't kind of, you wouldn't like line these two animals up, but again, God is comparing their dietary habits and the way they live. And he says, who provides the raven for his food? And it's like, when his young ones cry. You know, these are the hunters. And these have a quite an aggressive character about them. Interesting. You know, a group of lions is called a group of crows? Murder. Isn't that interesting? A murder of crows. So it's interesting the way those are paired up. And then he goes on to two different other animals, which are actually, you've gone now from, you might say fight, and now he's going to talk about flight, or the hunters to the hunted. So he now talks about the deer and the ibex. And these animals, he says, they live in remote places. They have to, because they're trying to keep away from the lion. They bring up, it says, do you know the time when the wild goats of the rocks spring forth? Or can you mark when their hinds do calve? So that's two different animals, by the way. They bow themselves, they bring forth their young ones, and they cast out their sorrows. And it's like, these animals are so independent and so strong, and it's like, you know, they give birth. It's like a seven-year-old suddenly saying, I'm leaving home now, I'm going to make my own way, see you later. So that's what it's saying. He said these animals are so sturdy and so hard because of the environment they're brought up in. Quite powerful, aren't they? And then he goes and talks about the wild ass and the wild ox together. No one's really quite sure what the wild ox is, but they suggest it might be this animal. It's often referred to as the unicorn. But both of these animals were very, very powerful creatures. But they're also very hard to manage, very, very stubborn. So you can't control a wild donkey like you can a domestic donkey. The onaga is a very, very powerful donkey, but it's hard to control. The wild ox, really, really difficult. But if you can harness that power, oh boy, have you got a worker. Then you've got the ostrich and the horse are put together. So these are interesting animals because they're seen by how fast they are. But also sometimes how neglectful, how stupid they are. Like the ostrich, it runs away from its nest to try to protect its nest, and then it comes back and forgets where its nest is. It's like, huh? And then the horse, it's like loving going into battle and has no idea that, you know, it's like outnumbered 10-1 and it might be for its life. So the horse rises up powerfully into battle, ready for a conflict, both animals, confrontational, but sometimes a bit misunderstanding in the confrontation. And the last one is the hawk and the falcon and the griffin. So there's two birds mentioned here, and obviously these are birds which are just live on a different level. They protect their families. They can see things from afar. You know, like an eagle can see a rabbit from 2 kilometres away, like 6 times optical zoom. So they're fierce animals, but they're so elevated in their life. Now, what's this all about? Why does God answer Job that way? Because all of these different animals represent different personalities. You know, Job had it all. Job was a very, very wealthy man, and he cared in his community. And you can imagine those in his community who suffered, who endured hardship, would go to Job and tell Job, about problems and different things because he was a priest in his community, and you can imagine Job saying, it's okay. You'll be all right if you just trust in the Lord. You know what? I don't know what you would say, but I'd say, that's easy for you to say, Job. Easy for you to say. Look at your world. You've got it made. Lovely family, lovely big mansion, estate. You're wealthy and rich. I've got nothing. You know what it's like to bring up kids in my environment. You don't know how hard it is. You haven't got people against you all the time. And so God brought Job to this position where all of a sudden he can be in touch with his community. You imagine after these events how Job could have gone to these people and say, look, I know it's hard. I know you're struggling to understand what God's doing in your life, but trust me. Trust me. I know it will work out okay. And everyone will look and go, yeah, you do know. You do know. Jesus is our high priest. He was touched in all points. He was tried in all points like as we are. He was touched with the feelings of our infirmities. He was able to be on the cross as the lions gathered around him to tear his flesh. The bulls of Bashan were there, and he was able to say, Father, forgive them. He was able to pray for the wicked, because sometimes the innocent suffer at the hand of the wicked. Paul stood at the feet of Stephen, who had been stoned, and he consented to his death. Paul was the lion then. He was the one that had brought down the innocent hind. He began as the roaring lion. He finished in a beautiful in terms of his character towards other people. And that's the story of the gems. Seeing the quality in other people, seeing the different personalities. By the way, we're doing the personality test with the kids. We've got a simple one going. So if you want to know what your teens are, a little bit of bribery, I'll be able to tell you what they are. So the other thing with bringing out, you know, the best quality in gems is there's a lot of process that goes on in trying to take a rough gemstone and bring out the quality. Jimmy was telling me this amazing story where we're talking about diamonds. So I think it's a guy in South Africa, isn't it? So he was looking for, you know, the black diamond. Was it the black diamond? Jimmy could probably tell the story, but anyway, it turns out that he sold his block of land, and on his block of land was the greatest resource of black diamonds that has ever been. But they were in the raw state, so he couldn't identify that they were actually diamonds. So he didn't know what he was actually looking for. And so, in the raw state, gems, sometimes you can't discern them. So they need a lot of work. There's a lot of washing and cleaning. And one of the big things is cutting and polishing. And they say, you know, with cutting and polishing, sometimes it takes like good gemstones like diamonds, like a cut like 7 times to bring out the best refraction and the quality of the gemstone. And when you see the work of the Lord Jesus Christ, there's a lot of work with cutting and polishing. In the story of Jesus, he says he knew who would betray him, and he said, not all of you are clean. And he sat down and washed the disciples' feet. And there were 2 people in that room at that moment that were going to be tried. Judas and Peter. Because on a previous occasion, when a woman washed Jesus' feet, Judas stood up amongst the disciples and said, what a waste. What a waste. That could have been sold for 300 pence and given to the poor. And it's the first time Jesus turned to Judas and he publicly rebuked him in front of all the disciples. Leave her alone. He defended Mary and he publicly rebuked Judas. So, and it's the only record of Jesus publicly rebuking Jesus. John 12, verse 4. You know what it says straight after that? Immediately after that, Mark 14, verse 10, Judas went out to betray Jesus. So you got publicly, no one likes public censorship. But this public censorship was the defining moment that Jesus said, I'll fix you, and walked out that door. Do you know, that of course led to his destruction. Out of that was the only one that Jesus lost of his disciples. Do you know, when it comes to Peter, on the same occasion of washing the disciples' feet, says, you shall never wash my feet. And Jesus turned around and publicly rebuked Peter and says, Peter, if I don't wash you, you have nothing to do with me. Do you know, that's the fifth of seven public rebukes that Jesus gives Peter. He rebukes Peter publicly seven times. Right from the very first time he's called, Peter's out there always about to say something. Oh, Lord, shall we build, you know, three tabernacles, one for you? And a voice comes from heaven. God publicly rebukes him. This is my son. Listen to him. Zip it. Put your hand on your mouth, Peter. Say, Lord, it shall not be. Stop, you're not going. Get behind me, Satan. Ouch. Ouch. Imagine that in front of the disciples. That went from, you know, glory to disaster in a few moments. You know, he had just said to Jesus, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, flesh and blood have not revealed this unto you, Peter, but my Father in heaven. That was beautiful. A few seconds later, he's calling him Satan. Get behind me, Satan. So constantly, Peter's been rebuked. But the beauty about Peter is a righteous man may fall seven times, but he'll rise again. The wicked will fall to his own calamity. Judas got publicly rebuked once and he fell to his calamity. Peter was constantly being cut by Jesus. And sometimes that's what's going to happen to us. Sometimes it's going to feel quite painful in the process of polishing a gem. Here's our final point about the gems, which I think is kind of cool. These days, the way they test quality of gems is by passing light through them. That's how they can test the quality of the gem, by how the light passes through the gem, or even the validity of a gem, about how the light passes through it. So some gemstones have like single refraction. They're called isotropic materials. The light passes through it, and it just goes straight through. Nothing happens. Some gemstones are anisotropic. So when the light passes through, it reacts with the material, and then it fragments the light, and you suddenly get birefringence. But basically, the light passes through and comes into two lights. Now, one of the interesting things is rubies are anisotropic materials. Light passes through. So one of the most famous of all gemstones is that which sits on the crown jewels, this massive big ruby, which it's actually called the Great Impostor. So it goes all the way back, the Black Prince's ruby, which was found, it was 170 carats, and it was in the 14th century, and it ends up on the crown jewels of the Queen. But it's actually a spinel. It's not a ruby. So if you were to pass light through it. So it's not a genuine ruby, it just looks like a ruby. Still pretty cool, but it's a fake, if you like. So when you go to the 12 stones in Revelation, although we can't identify exactly what they are, we know the families of the stones that are there. We know that they generally come from the sardonyx family or the chalcedony family, and we can align them. But what we do know is that, like, even if there's a debate in terms of which ones are which, every single one of those gems are anisotropic. Every single one of those gems, when the light hits it, it passes through and it fragments and it creates its own glory. And the thing that this is telling me, which is beautiful, and whether this was, you know, like it's just a coincidence or not, I don't think so. Because I think the point is when the light hit Judas, it didn't refract, did it? He was definitely not anisotropic material. He was an isotropic being because he didn't refract that light. And when the light affected him, he couldn't change. And in the Lord's work with us, it's his glory which passes through us. And here's the other interesting thing. What's the difference between the gemstones on the breastplate under the law and the gemstones in New Jerusalem? You can't see through the gemstones on the breastplate, can you? If you were to shine light on the breastplate, you've got something that's preventing the light from shining through. You have a mortal priesthood that stands in its way. Aaron stands in the way of light passing through. The light can't pass through a mortal priesthood. But when you come to Revelation chapter 21, the light goes straight through because you have an immortal priest, a high priest who's passing in heaven, one that is not flesh and blood, one that is spirit being. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts. In the day I make up my jewels,